Are you a big brain of the beautiful game? Prove it with the great new app that'll test your...
Shoot the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. I'm your host, Stel, and joining me is the head of performance analysis at Buffers FC. It's Charlie Mitchell. Charlie, welcome to the show, mate. How you doing?
Hi, mate. Thanks for having me on. It's brilliant.
Oh, great to have you on, mate. Great to have you on. And you know, you've been in Cyprus since January. How are you finding it?
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, as I was saying to you before, everyone's been really, really welcoming, not just from a staff and player perspective, but the locals as well. You know, we can't find enough as a coaching team, you know. They've really helped the guys settle in. Obviously, that's helped us focus our mindset onto the pitch as well. So, you know, that's really good. And obviously, now we're looking to build into this season. So, you know, hopefully everything's looking positive and we'll go from there.
Okay, brilliant. Fantastic. All right, well, before we talk about your role at the club, let's go all the way back to when you were at university. I know you studied Bachelor of Science in Sports Coaching and you did a Master's in Science. Now, how does that relate to what you do now?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we've taken from the course itself and implemented it in sort of an analysis setting. I mean, from my personal point of view, my main goal in life is to be coaching within the professional football environment, but obviously that's really difficult as an early progression. So it's something that obviously it's a slow burner, but you're always looking to learn and learn from other coaches and managers alike. And I've been lucky to work with a variety of coaches and managers that have got massive experience. And it was likewise on the course as well. So there's people from lots of different backgrounds, lecturers that had different backgrounds in coaching, analysis, the science side of coaching as well, also the theory. So, for example, we did one module on sort of game modelling, which is basically how you perceive your sport should be played. So, for example, in football, it's like a manager's philosophy, how they would implement that within their environment. We have to do a presentation on that, and that's really helped me think about how I see the game, speaking to other coaches, and how I feel football should be played. And you see it now, obviously, with different managers I've worked with, they've all got different models, and that's really interesting. So it's nice to try and learn that way and take different bits from that. Then there's also stuff about understanding the athletes you work with. That's a really, really big one that I took from the course. So it's about understanding the context that you work in. So sort of looking at a who, what and how model. So, for example, you're looking at the who, so obviously not just who the athlete is, it's about their background. For example, it could be even as down to a T as IQ, it could be their personalities, you know, are they open to things like performance analysis, or are they in the latter stages of their career where, you know, they don't need too much guided learning to help them develop. In terms of the what, obviously the type of environment you're in, so like I said, I've worked in the male game, the female game, abroad and in the UK, and there's big differences on where analysis is in those contexts, and then how you do it as well. So then that's obviously then how I go about undertaking the performance analysis setting with the coaches and the players as well. So yeah, it's a big vast range of experience that I took from the degree, not just from a networking point of view, but from also an academic purpose. And you know, a lot of it's sort of come to fruition, if you like. And now as well, for example, I wrote my dissertation on tactical periodization, which is quite a big thing in coaching now. You see a lot of people on the A licence, and courses I like are studying this, and it's something that I'm actually part of, something that was used in a lot of the environments I've worked in now. So, you know, it's something that I've seen that how it's actually come to life in a proper setting.
Mm. And do you know what I find interesting? You do hear a lot of people saying, well, you haven't played the game, so how do you know about it? But being someone who's been doing podcasts for a hell of a long time, has been watching the game, been a student of the game, you don't necessarily have to kick the ball at a high level to understand the game. Sure, the physical aspect is obvious, but at the same time, your knowledge, your understanding from a tactical perspective, physical perspective, it's not something that you can just walk into, is it?
No, I think playing the game gives you an advantage in some cases, and it's not necessarily gets you a job, but also you learn the game in a different way. Because obviously you've been coached here, you get to see coaches every day on the grass, and you sort of take different elements of that, and you can see that in the way ex-players can coach. You see different personalities of managers they've worked with. But from my perspective, it was kind of decision in the late teenage years, okay, you're definitely not going to be able to play, so what's the next step that you know can get you into that environment to start with, which obviously how I ended up at Leeds, and then how do I then progress into the ultimate goal that I want to achieve, you know? And that's, you know, I've been lucky to be part of the professional football setting for nearly 5 years now, and I'm trying to obviously now progress into further positions within the game.
Brilliant. Alright, well, let's talk about your stint at Leeds United. You were there for a good year or so, I'd say, weren't you? So you're the performance analyst for the first team. I think Gary Monk was in charge at the time, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I was, as part of my master's degree, I was there for that season.
Oh, wow.
I did my master's over 2 years, so that one of the seasons I served at Leeds was part of that master's degree. So that was a great learning experience. So, you know, there's two analysts there that had quite a lot of experience in the game, so that was a good chance to then. You know, I'd never done it before. I'd shown an interest in performance analysis, but I'd never undertaken the role. So I was really interested to sort of go in there fresh, not know anything about how to use, you know, the different types of software that the analysts use, and you know how they watch the game in such detail, and sort of just the unseen work that nobody sees. You know, and just everything that goes into something before a game, to give to the coaches. And then I got to see obviously Gary work firsthand, and you know Pep's assistant and James Beattie, people that you know that you'd seen as a kid, you know, James Beattie playing in the Premier League and you know, scoring goals. You see, it's amazing to be in front of people like that. And yeah, the time there is really good, and I think that was a great starting point for me, really, because in terms of Ryan needs as a head of analysis under Gary, he gave me lots of opportunities to learn, and sort of get to grips with what the role was like, and yeah, that really stood me in good stead at the end of that season, then to go forward and go, yeah, this is something I want to do, and then try and progress up the career ladder.
And I guess as a performance analyst, you'll be working, or you are working alongside every different department in the squad, be it, you know, first team coaches, head physios, strength and conditioning coaches. Going into Leeds United, who undoubtedly are a huge club, and they were going through a little bit of a rocky period at the time, and we've seen how Bielsa's changed the mechanics of the club, so to speak, but did you feel under any pressure to kind of stand out while you were there, or is it simply, well, you were doing your course, so you were there simply for your educational purposes?
No, I felt under pressure, because it was, you know, you understood the enormity of the club that you were working for, and the people that you were doing work for as well. And it's like, right, I don't want to mess this up. I want to get this absolutely bang on. One, to not only impress the people in the environment, but also, you know, to make sure it's right, so ultimately they can go and prepare the players for a top performance on the weekend. And it's great, you know. I think it's good to see as well people that there that I've worked with, like, you know, Calvin Phillips, for example, was just coming through at the time under Gary, and he started playing first team games, and now he's obviously going to be a Premier League central midfielder, and it's a great little thing to know that you've had a small albeit a very small part in his journey over the last few years. And going back to sort of the enormity of things and the pressure, I'd say so. I think it was more the pressure of, right, I'm new here, I don't want to let anyone down, that type of thing, more than anything else. I think it was more the pressure from within. And when you put pressure on yourself as well, you obviously mistakes do happen. But that was all part of the learning process. But people were very understanding, and they helped me in many ways to sort of guide me along with you know what to do and how to handle the environment and deal with different things with that. And you also got first hand to see how people made those decisions as well under pressure. Mm. So that was even just on the outside looking in, you know, people under serious intense pressure, and you know they weren't all positive times that season. And you know it was a very good season at the time for Leeds United, and it was, you know, it was really, really, really valuable for me to see that sort of environment so early on in my life as well.
Yeah, I can imagine, because when you look at the size of the club, when you look at the chairman at the time,
yeah.
And I can understand the amount of pressure these players were under to perform. They just about missed out on the playoffs that season, but they had the likes of Pablo Hernandez, who's still there, Pontus Janssen, fantastic defender who's at Brentford, I believe, at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah.
And also Chris Wood, who's firing on all cylinders at Burnley. So it was a very, I wouldn't say highly experienced group of players, but why do you think it went wrong from that season?
Well, I think, well, Gary had a lot of faith in, this is just again from what I saw at the time, I think Gary had a lot of faith in the lineup that he had, and I think that they were hampered by quite a few injuries as well, sort of in that sort of that mid to latter stages of the season, which didn't help. You know, when a lot of the time when teams like to rotate between a Saturday and a Tuesday game, they didn't. You know, obviously they didn't really have the opportunity to do that, so I think they're a bit unfortunate in that respect. And then the problem is then I think that the run of fixtures that they had required them to, you know, really need to rotate, because also I think they were playing, I think I remember one week it was Brentford Reading Brighton or something on the lines of that, I think it was, and that season they were massive games, and every game's a big game, obviously, not to be too cliche, but they were they are, but I think where those teams were in the league at the time, I think, you know, they had to consistently play the same 11-12 players, but then even if they were carrying not sure injuries, again they couldn't really rotate because of the amount of injuries that we had at the time.
Okay, let's talk about stats perform, because what I'm finding out more and more these days is that scouting players is still going on, but they're using more data, analytics and all that kind of stuff. And I know Paul Powers created this fantastic platform with Media and Tech and Artificial Intelligence. How did you get into stats perform, and what would you say you learnt most from your stint there?
In terms of learning from it, I'll go back to how I got into it. In terms of learning from it, it was sort of two learning processes for me, really. There's one, actually being live at the game and sort of taking different bits of information in, while actually trying to sort of feed back with the data. So my job really was to be basically at the game and feed back the live data to, you know, the officers, so obviously they could publish that on different sites, you know, whether it was betting, whether it was through the Opta platform, different varied things. But the main thing for me was more of an upskilling process. So, like, for example, when what analysts do at games, so they'll collect clips for tactical purposes, for example. So, say if they've seen something during the game and they want to have a word, show something to the coach at half time. This is what, you know, this is, for example, if they're getting down the right hand side, this is why they're getting down the right hand side, or if they've seen a weakness in the opposition that could be exploited, that's what they show. But then also, we collect statistical data as well. So that really upskilled me in that process of just being able to be quick in watching the game, but also being able to, what we call coding, and collect that information live, you know, which is quick. You're obviously sort of reacting to the decisions that are made in front of you. But then, in terms of how I got into it, it was just an opportunity that sort of came up. I was just out of university at the time, from a bachelor's. So I did two stints there, and it was just an opportunity of a live, I think it was Live Data Scouts, I think it was. So I think, oh, that sounds interesting. So it was in terms of, you could feedback on the game, but also sort of feedback on the data side of things as well. So that was really interesting for me, really, to sort of, so it was almost like a mini version of being a performance analyst, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it was quite interesting.
Yeah. Does it frustrate you when people keep bringing up Football Manager? Because that seems to be the go-to game for a lot of people, and especially on social media, they're like, oh yeah, I signed this player and he plays at this club and whatnot, and yeah, they've got a lot to answer to, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think I haven't actually played it in quite a few years now, which is a bit embarrassing, I have to say that. I used to love it in my teenage years, but I think the amount of data that's in the world now and in on football, and you'll see it improve over time, probably in the next 5 years, I think we're due quite a big influx of this, you know, sort of a data revolution within football. It's already happening, but I think it's going to hit its peak now. And I think games like that are influenced by, you know, what's available at the moment. So that's why they're not sure that far wrong in their predictions and the algorithms they got in within it. But yeah, I think it does get a bit frustrating, because I think, you know, I think obviously in those games you get a chance to sort of play God with football, don't you? You know, you can sort of, you can take unrealistic teams from, you know, from in an 8-year run from, I don't know, the bottom of the tier to the top of the Premier League, and it's you know, in terms of football reality, there's a lot of, you know, that needs to happen for that scene to that to occur. But no, it's I think, in terms of statistics and stuff, I think I don't get frustrated with being referred to as the man with the stats or anything like that. I think it's an important part, but as long as they're relevant. For example, so anything we collect, I collected at Wales, Leeds, Paphos, it relates to how we want to play. It's not just like counting passes, these types of things. That's not what we do. It's relevant. You know, if we, for example, you know, it could be, if we're looking at an opposition team that have played a high percentage of long balls, we know they're going to be direct. This is these little things that we can use to get an advantage of how teams might play or how we can play.
Okay, let's move on to Doncaster Bells.
Yes.
Now, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I seem to remember when I was growing up, they used to show women's football on Channel 4, and Doncaster Bells were pretty much destroying every team in their path. So what happened?
Yeah, it's such a sad thing. I mean, what a great club. Again, very lucky to be part of this in terms of just the enormity of the club. And unfortunately, they were just, I don't know what happened off the field, but I don't think there was an adequate amount of support there for the club. Not about fan base, I'm on about sort of structure and stability. And that's why, unfortunately, they had to fold and drop out of the professional leagues. But in terms of a club with proud history and tradition, it was really nice to be a part of, just from people in the environment that have been in the women's game for years. I think in terms of, again, an early learning experience for me to sort of be a part of that and actually take some, because at the club at Doncaster I actually took on more of a role, being very close to the manager in terms of how feeding back and having discussions about how, you know, how we thought the game went, how we're going to prepare for the next game, our progress, you know, these conversations that I'd not really had before. And it sort of came to life with me when Emma Coates is the manager there at the time. She said, "What do you think?" And I was like, "What do you mean? What do I think?" That's what you do. But it's nice to be trusted in an opinion. That was completely wrecked. I think every manager and coach works differently, and I think that was something that was really, really new for me. You know, to be so young and naturally trusted in an opinion in such an important environment for Emma and the staff that were around her. And then obviously that progressed to Neil Redfern being there, and the girls went on to win the WSL 2 title in 2018, I think it was, and it was just before I left for Wales. And you know, that again, it's nice to see, because in that team there's players now playing in the top flight of WSL, you know, playing for Manchester United, Jess Sigsworth, Hansen, you know, Rhiannon Roberts, who's at Liverpool, lucky to have her at Wales as well. You know, people doing so well, and it's just such a shame, because obviously their players are massive potential, and obviously Doncaster's unfortunately folded and gone down the leagues.
Yeah, sad, very sad.
But yeah.
Tell me something, what did you notice from a statistical perspective or an analytical perspective between men and women footballers?
I can't draw upon too much. I think the games are completely different within their own right, so there's different reasons for that, but I did as an example, so I did like a study into how teams attack the final third. So I did one on the Championship when I was working at Leeds, and I also did one on Doncaster Bells, because that was sort of the environment that I was working in. And I sort of found there was subtle differences in how teams attack the final third. Not the number, the numbers were very different, very similar, sorry. But it was actually the types of final third attacks. So, for example, in the Championship, I think at the time there was a high percentage of 1v1 final third attacks and sort of 2v1 overload situations. So that'd be where fullbacks are overlapping and underlapping, or you know, different types of movements from wide players. Whereas in WSL 2, there was actually a high percentage of crosses and 1v1s. So whether that, you could argue, is that a physical thing, a fullback's not getting on as much, or is the tactical structure just different? So there's a couple of things there, but the problem is, well, I think where women's football's actually getting to now, which is again good to see, is that there's not too much variance between the teams. So I use international football as an example. If you look at rankings, this is a fair assumption, I think if you look at rankings 1 to 50 in the men's game, those games are relatively competitive across the board. But if you did 1 to 50, 60 in the women's game, you would have to probably break it up into sort of two halves, really.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
But slowly, it's progressing down the line now. So, like, for example, at Wales, I think we're 33rd, and we managed, and under Jane we got to our highest ever world ranking in the 20s. But we were competitive in every game, you know, and that showed in the results, and you know, the unbeaten run that we went on. But you can tell there's a clear difference between the lower end of the rankings and the top end of the rankings in women's football. In terms of club football as well, there's a little bit of a jump between the full-time and part-time teams in the WSL, and it's slowly getting addressed, but I'm hoping that comes along sooner rather than later, because there's such a big difference between being in a full-time environment, not just from an analyst perspective, but from a, you know, physically, the care you get, the amount of staff you have, so many things that sort of fall into it. And then, you know, you're playing teams that may train twice a week and have three or four staff that not all of them are full time.
Yeah, exactly. I think there isn't enough money in the women's game to elevate it to the heights that perhaps a lot of people would like.
Yeah, and I'm hopeful that we'll see a rapid progression next 2 or 3 years. I think it's helping. What will help is the Premier League teams, Championship teams, in the men's game will start putting more money into their clubs. And it was sad to see as well with the COVID situation that, you know, women's football was put at such risk. I think that was probably in some cases unfairly reported, but I also think it was, you know, a shame if that was to be the sacrifice. I don't think that would be the right way to go about anything, really. But I'm glad that, you know, now I speak to a lot of the players I used to work with at Wales, and I'm glad that they're back in training now and they're ready to go for their next season.
Okay, you mentioned Wales, great segue. great segue. Actually, no, because we'd have skipped Bradford City, sorry. We just skipped Bradford City because you were there for five or six months, I think, something like that.
Yeah, I was actually close to going back. Very, very close. It was, again, I keep talking about learning experiences, but again, I'm just talking about this from a perspective of someone that's still relatively young and working in football. But I had sort of variance in education across the coaches I worked with. So obviously, under Gary Monk, it was a specific way of playing. Under Emma at Doncaster, it was a specific way of playing. But then coming to Bradford in an academy environment where I've not actually worked before, you know, I've worked in first team environments, so it's all about winning games every week. Whereas the academy environment at Bradford is about, okay, how do we develop players for the first team? And that was completely new. And again, that was a good learning experience on how to practice my performance analysis practice, as you will, to help improve the players and, you know, help inform coaches of, you know, players' development plans, for example, and hopefully produce one or two players for the first team, which obviously in teams like Bradford, it's money for them. You know, if they get one or two players into the first team, they get one or two successful seasons out of them, they sell them on, that's a profit. So that's a big thing for the lower league clubs. But under Michael Collins and Martin Drury, who were, you know, good friends, they're still really good friends of mine from my time there. The brand of football they wanted to play, I was really, really excited about playing. Just not just from, because it was an academy environment. Okay, let's try and play off and about. Let's do all these different types of things. But they were all in, you know, all in possession, high press. It was just great. It was great fun to watch them coach that and sort of experience it myself. And when it was done well, you know, that was the best rewarding part of it. In terms of just 6 months, I wish that in hindsight the journey was a little bit longer, because I think it'd been nice to sort of see how that working relationship would have played out over sort of maybe 12-18 months, you know. But we keep in touch a lot. I mean, I speak to Michael most weeks, so it's, hopefully maybe it's a working relationship we could rekindle in the future.
Well, the thing is, when you look at Yorkshire as a whole, there are so many clubs in that region. Yeah. Obviously, you've got the Sheffield clubs, Rotherham, Leeds, Huddersfield. Blimey, that's just to mention a few. Barnsley, Doncaster. So how difficult is it recruiting the younger players, especially within that catchment? It must be very tricky, given that a lot of them are sport for choice, especially the best ones.
Yeah, and I think there's, you see with Huddersfield now, also have scrapped the academy programme,
and they've
followed the Brentford model, which some, you know, there's arguments for and against it, but in terms of costing and how they pick the players up, there's a lot of positives in that. But because, like you say, in Yorkshire there's 6, 7, 8 clubs. I mean, there's other teams like Halifax Town, for example, in conference, who've got an 18 set up, and they rely on 18s as well. But you'll often see, especially within a place like Yorkshire, that the players will jump from team to team throughout their teenage years, obviously striving to be at the team that's the highest category level, and then fall down through the categories until they can find, you know, a place where they can hopefully go into the first team. But the competitiveness, I think, waters down the quality of what you're looking for, and that's the key thing. So whereas I think if you were to combine all of Yorkshire together, you could produce probably 8 to 10 players a year, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But whereas clubs like Bradford maybe now have a gem one every 2 years maybe, and that's where the instability comes in then.
Because
from a financial model it doesn't work. But again, it's how you run things, and Bradford obviously is quite lucky. They've had a track record of producing players for and selling them on for big money.
There you go. Brilliant. Okay, so you made the jump to the Welsh Football Association. First of all, how did they discover you?
I have to be honest. I saw this role. I was sort of, I didn't want to move from Bradford. I was quite happy working, as I said before, working with Michael and Martin and the club. This role came up, and I thought, oh, I've not got a chance in hell of getting this job. I'll chuck an application in. And I was actually sat in a Bradford City office one day, and the phone rang, and I was answering. It was, okay, oh hi Charlie, how are you doing? So and so from Blush Football Association. We'd like to offer you a chance to come and interview for the job. I was like, oh, I couldn't believe it. So I obviously go down to Wales. And obviously end up getting the job. And within this week, I'm talking second and third week of December, starting the first week of January. So I had 10 days to find a flat in Newport.
Wow.
In South Wales. it's a case of find the nicest one you can and for a decent amount of money, and then get yourself down there after Christmas. So I had to up and leave, and obviously sort of slamming it up. And I managed to get everything boxed off there and make sure they weren't left in any poor state. But they were delighted that I got a role within a national team setup. And then obviously going down there and enjoying the next sort of 2.5 years, as you would. And that was a great, great experience for me. So, you know, the people I got to work with there, people I got to know, some very close friends I've got now from that job. You know, it was brilliant how it all played out, really.
Mm. Okay, well, the first question I've got to ask you about this role, tell me about the facilities and what you had at your disposal to make your job easier.
They were, if to be honest, they were a complete step up from what I've been used to before.
Right.
In terms of, it wasn't a case of ask for what you will and you get it. There was obviously a budget to work within. They're not, you know, national governing bodies. People have got this perception that the governing bodies are sort of an endless pot of money. The FAW fight hard and do well to get the money they have within it, and they also rely on their teams being successful. So that's why the biggest thing they had in place there was like a high performance culture, and that was set across every department. No matter what department you worked in, they set out, you know, these are the standards and the values that we work to, and that was quite clear to be seen across the board. And in terms of facilities, I was based at Dragon Park in Newport, and that's a great facility in terms of an office environment. And every day you're working with the analysts from every single team. You'll see the coaches come in now and again, and you get to chat with them quite, you know, just on an ad hoc basis, but you get into great conversations with them. The FAW's got obviously a great coach education team as well. You see the types of coaches that, you know, they've produced over the last few years. For example, like, you know, Mikel Arteta is obviously at Arsenal now, just to name one of many. And, you know, they've got, you know, great people to speak to in that environment as well. When it says facilities, you know, got the pitches at Dragon Park are great. That's where the women's train the majority of the time. And then we also were based out of University of South Wales, which is an unbelievable facility. People that go to study there to study, you know, coaching and performance, similar degree to myself, have got an unbelievable environment to work in there. You know, they've got, I think there's 4 or 5 pitches, 2 3G pitches, you know, endless amount of facilities to work with there. And then the men's are obviously based down at the Vale, which I know that's where the FAW are going to be moving to soon. And that's a great facility as well, where they've sort of built their own little training centre there now, and the analysis department's fitted it out with, you know, all the mod cons, as you would, and that's going to stand them in good stead as well.
Brilliant. Okay, next question. Now, this has always kind of baffled me. You're laughing already. I think you know what's coming. So you've got teams that play once or maybe twice a week. So you, being a performance analyst, you got 2 games max a week to look back on from a statistical perspective. But when you got the national team who play once every 3-4 months, or maybe twice every 2 or 3 months, how does that affect your job?
I was quite thankful for that, actually, at some point, because it meant you were either winning, you're on a long unbeaten run, or you were, you know, you weren't losing every week. but the main thing for me, really, I think thing for our role is making sure you're prepared and making sure the coaches are prepared. And there was really no excuse in that environment to make sure that you'd box everything off, from watching individual players of the opposition. You're watching, you know, everything tactically. You could watch an endless amount of games and, you know, get everything to Jane and the coaching team, say, right, this is what you got to come up against. You know, there you go. Let's formulate a game plan. But I have to be honest, the games were a lot more regularly for me in terms of the women's setup. So fortunate or unfortunate, depends which way you look at it. I Jane and her coaching staff work more teams than anybody else within the FAW. So they work actually all the way across from senior team level to, you know, the under-16s, under-15s rather. So they're working across four teams. So she's the coaching team have got to dedicate their time to every single team, whereas within the men's environment, the coaches maybe work across one or two teams.
Right.
And the same with the analysts as well. So I was spread across four age groups, if you would. So that was a lot of time where we'd be away. So I was away more than anybody else from an analysis office perspective, but that was good for me because I prefer the regular games. I think that was one thing I did miss while working in Wales, was a game every week. You know, the build to a game is nice, and having game day and sort of being able to enjoy that weekly was good from a club perspective. But it placed more pressure on you. We talked about pressure earlier. That the pressure on the games are a lot higher for me because you've worked and built it for two or three months. You've got two games in a week. You need to win these games because you saw Wales men's campaign. You know, the two or three wins in a row, that changes the picture completely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in a way, and it does in the league as well. But in the league, if you win, you're talking 4, 5, 6 in a row, then that changes the picture completely. One win doesn't always make a massive amount of difference, but you know, one or two wins in a international qualifying campaign could propel you straight into the top two.
Fantastic. Do you know what? Sorry about this, mate. There's a helicopter flying overhead, right? And I swear I don't know what's happening. This has never happened before on the podcast, but I'm going to leave this bit in anyway because what you said was very, very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of people heard what you said. Don't worry, hopefully they'll go away in a minute. Go away, catch them. Whoever they are you're trying to catch them. Anyway.
It's probably Jane trying to see.
I know teams are using drones these days, and Tottenham's training ground is only around the corner, but crikey. Do you think Daniel Levy had that money in his pocket to get a helicopter, mate? There we go. Right. Okay, so tell me something. You joined Wales round about the back end of that kind of golden generation after Euro 2016, had a fantastic campaign. Chris Coleman was still there, but yet he was still blooding a lot of youngsters at the time. I know Ethan Ampadu came in, David Brooks is another one, Tom Lawrence. So these younger players. Now, for you, based on your previous experiences, was it difficult to kind of, I don't know, analyse many footballers, because you've got a bigger pool of talent at your disposal, don't you? Even though it's a national team like Wales, you've got a bigger pool of talent at your disposal to look at and study, as opposed to when you're at a club where you've got 25, 30 players, no?
Yeah, I'll probably speak on behalf of sort of the men's analysts and sort of the age group analysts there as well. It's quite funny as well, because I won't say too funny, but Chris left in my first week, I think.
Okay.
So I never actually got to meet Chris. I've heard of him through all the guys there and how they speak of him. Obviously they speak so highly of him, not just because of the campaign, but because of how, you know, how he worked within the environment. And then obviously Ryan being appointed was within the first month I was there. But in terms of how everyone works within that environment, they, as you've acknowledged, you know, they're a smaller nation in respect of size and population, and in terms of how they went about sort of looking for these players, they've got a very, very foolproof program. The FAW, I think, that's got, obviously, it's got a track record of developing national team players, men's and women's aligned. I think that the best thing that they do is that they locate, particularly on the boys' side, they locate talent early and Welsh heritage. They're very good at that. And then the convincing, you know, if they need convincing to play for Wales and the reasons why, if they've got a, you know, a sort of a dual heritage there, but then also blood in the you know, we call it full Welsh, as you would, if you, you know, born there. They're very good at getting them in to the environment early, introducing to the way of playing. So, like, I think it's as early as 11, 12 years old. They do regional camps where they'll bring them in, you know, probably once, I think it's once or twice quarterly. And this is the way we want to play, just introducing these to small principles. And then, you know, over time, building up to under 15s, it's, you know, it's regular contact then. And the coaches are very good at that. And then this is where the analysis department actually comes in, funny enough, with it as well. I think what the strength of what Esther, James, Sarius have all done with the youth side of things is upload things for players to watch constantly. So they're constantly having to watch how examples of themselves playing, but also how good examples of how, as a national team, Wales looks. And that's coming from top to bottom. They call it the Welsh way.
So it's like an educational tool, no?
Yes, 100%. Right. So it's like, I think it's called MyTPE. And they basically, it's like a platform where they upload, you can upload videos, clips, presentations, whatever you will, and the analysts and coaches can see if players have looked at it and how long they've watched it for, or how many times they've looked at it, and they can comment on it, and they can have a conversation with the coach, you know, saying, oh, you know, what would I do in this situation? Or, you know, you can post questions and answers, and it gets a lot of good interaction there. And that was something we did well. I think Jane and myself did well with our younger age groups. In the women's setup, we did that very well in terms of setting tasks for players and feedback. See, you don't see them often. You know, they're in the club environment where they've been asked to play a certain way. Under, you know, like we spoke about game models earlier. That's the game model of that club. That's how they're going to play. And then they've got to come into an international environment and probably change quite a few things to fit how they want to play for Wales. And they're only at Wales probably, you know, 20, 30 days a year. Yeah. So, yeah, it does affect how players learn. The ones that they're adaptable, the ones that are big achievers, you see, like, you know, we'll give examples on the men's side, Harry Wilson, you know, you see David Brooks, Ethan Ampadu. Again, Ethan Ampadu's a good example. You know, he's played a few different ways. He's, you know, he's been in a Chelsea environment for quite a long time, but now he's in Germany. And obviously the German way of playing, you know, is completely different. And when he comes back to play for Ryan now at Wales, like, again, has to do different things.
Yeah, so, but what about being versatile, I guess? And, yeah, it's the game's evolving, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think again, with the increase of the analysis side of things, sports science, you know, players are constantly being educated now. And you'll see, I think we'll see better football knowledgeable players now. I think, I was saying before, in the past it was all instinctive, but I don't think now there's more of a challenge on learning. So yeah. I think that's where you'll see a progression in that.
Yeah. And I think over the years, obviously, as the game has evolved, the demands have changed. And, you know, if you look at, say, the 60s, it was acceptable to turn up to training pissed, like George Bestwood, so to speak, you know, and score 6 goals against, you know, Northampton, whatever. But then nowadays you've got, you know, you've got databases, you've got to code and analyse matches, you've got to produce, I don't know, motivational material for players and upload video clips, you know. But at the same time, you've got to take into account the psychological effect of it as well. So I don't envy you. You've got a great job. I don't envy you.
You get the best of both in a way. You get to, you know, you're constantly watching the game, not just on educating yourself, but then you're seeing the development of the players. And then also the development, obviously, how the staff put it across the players as well. So you're getting sort of the best of everything, which I really like about my job. You know, I think if I was, you know, to sit here and speak football with you 5 years ago, this podcast would have gone a completely different way. I don't think I could have gone into, I definitely couldn't have gone into the depth that we've sort of gone into so far today. You know, I think again, and I think again, in 5 years' time, that would be that would be the same again.
Yeah, and I think 5 years ago, it'd have been a copper jumping over my fence into my back garden, as opposed to a helicopter flying overhead. But yeah, no, but I get what you mean. But at the same time, you know, you had two fantastic years at the FAW. What would you say was the most satisfying moment of your time there?
Well, obviously, worked on the women's side, so there's a few. I was very lucky to come in the middle of the historic qualifying campaign that we had, where we so nearly made it to the World Cup. And missing out to your nation of your birth on the last game was quite a bitter one to swallow. But there's a few sweet moments in there. I think starting from the draw in Southampton against England, there's not many times you celebrate a draw, but there was a few reasons for this. So it was more the pure energy and effort that went into the build up to that game. So a couple of months prior, we went to the Cyprus Cup, ironically, obviously that's where I am now, but we prepared, planned, executed in three games against high level opposition. Four games against high level opposition in Cyprus, the game plan that we were going to do against England, and we had a lot of success with it, and we knew, okay, this is what we're going to have to do against who were actually the number one ranked side in the world at the time if we're going to get anything out of this, because England were the clear favourites. They don't even have, you know, just a squad of 25. They could call upon 50, 60 players at least, you know, that are playing full time professionally within the WSL. Whereas we had a handful of professionals, handful of part time players, and actually a handful of amateurs in our starting 11. And we went there and got a result on that magnitude. And it really, people sat up then and going, oh, hang on a minute, someone's come to the table here. And then what followed on from that was this bounce effect then, and this is where I really loved working with Jane, because she's so that's the best way to put it, it's not instinctive, but she's so good at identifying a weakness in the opposition, and she knew how to act on it. Right. And it was the best I've seen at making plans for games in my career so far. And it was just how quickly she could identify something and execute something on the training pitch with the girls. Like, for example, just as simple as changing from a one up front to a two up front, but still needing to play a back five against Russia, and the goals we scored in the game all linked to that. And we obviously won the game 3-0. Again, tore apart a team that was far above our ranking. And then we won 7 out of 8 games unbeaten. You know, clean sheets, 7 out of 8 clean sheets as well, which is tough to do international level. And as well, there's other things as well, satisfying moments. Obviously, the youth age groups, you don't have much contact with the girls on the senior level that often, but you see the youth age groups even less. And we managed to get them qualifying for elite rounds consistently. I think it was, I want to say we had a 3 out of 4 record when I was there in terms of qualifying for elite rounds. So that was massive. And that's not just from a personal perspective for us as coaches, but it was, you know, it gave us belief in our ideas and how we wanted to move forward with not just the youth, but also the senior teams as well. And then obviously shifting to the men's side, you know, the guys have obviously qualified for the upcoming Euros. And I think, again, another rewarding thing, I think, going back to the girls as well, is there to see so many of them flourish now in WSL. As I said, that lineup from the England game in March 2018, if you were to put the same lineup up now, far more of them are professional, full-time. and more of the squad now on the whole is involved in at least a semi-pro and above environment, which is, you know, is massive. And development of Welsh football is on the rise now with the women's game. I think, I know at the time there was a high level, the highest level of participation numbers in women's football. I think it was the same on the boys' side as well, I want to say. So they, all of this helps from what I spoke about earlier about how we they go about identifying players and bringing them into the national team setup, and, you know, and educating them early on. And then it's a repetitive process over 3 or 4 years, and then you can pick them out then and they're ready to play for Wales at international level.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Just one more question based on Wales. And I know it's got nothing to do with what you just said, but what do you make of Real Madrid's treatment of Gareth Bale? And how do you think your ex-colleagues would make of it?
Well, I think they'd be obviously annoyed that he's not getting on the pitch and playing. I think any, you know, doesn't matter whatever your club you're at, I think players want to play football. I know the Spanish media would probably argue something different, but I know for a fact when Gareth comes to Wales, and I've seen him, you've seen him live doing this consistently, that he's a different level when he puts on a Welsh national team jersey. And it'd be the same if he got on the play and got on the pitch for Real Madrid or any other team if he moves on this summer. You know, I think he's a rare talent when given the chance to perform, and just to see someone like that live. Just, you know, for Wales and in just connecting with that young talent, you know, like Dan James and Conor Roberts and the other players that we mentioned earlier, that just shows how exciting Welsh football is going to be in the next couple of years.
Right, so let's talk about Buffer, home of Coral Bay and Aphrodite and Bedrag Romeu, which is a big rock in the middle of the sea that hundreds and thousands of people go to see. I don't get it, but then again, you know, I'm from that background, and every year my mum and dad used to take me there. I'm like, let's go Bedrag Romeu. I'm saying, why? It's a rock, but there's history, and I'm not going to knock it because, yeah, the tourism board love it. But yeah, this is a bit of a random one for me, Charlie. I mean, my team is Omonia. So don't hang up just yet, right? That's my team in Cyprus.
First game of the season, yeah.
I mean, look, they've gone through a similar transition to Buffer, in the sense that there's a new owner, big financial clout behind them, I guess. But they're trying to change things in the background and lower the wage bill, lower the average age of the club. And I know that Jason Punchin is out there at the moment at Buffer. So first of all, wow, why Cyprus? I mean, how did this come about?
It was an interesting one. I know people back home said, well, that's ballsy. but I think from multiple reasons, really. I was excited about the project that was sort of, you know, Jeremy Steele, the sporting director, contacted me. He said, look, This is the project. These are the plans. We want you to come in and be head of department. You know, I led my side of things at Wales, and obviously I've been on my own at other clubs as well. And I obviously was a head role at Bradford, but again, that was, you know, was limited in terms of what you could do. But this was first team environment. Goals was to be, you know, the goals you want to be playing in the Europe within so many years, you know, again, like Ammonia, you know, they've obviously finished high last season, they're going to be playing in Europe this year, you know, similar sort of goals. And, you know, from that's something I've not done. You know, I've done international football, I've done high level football in the UK, but now European football is an opportunity you don't normally get as an analyst. So that was something that really stood out for me. And then the other side of things as well was, the coaches, you know, I know Rich Buchanan, who's head of performance here. I did my B licence with Rich, and you know, he spoke nothing but highly of Cameron and Gary Richards, who was obviously the coaches here. And that side of things as well. And again, coming to this environment and to learn from and work with those people, that was an opportunity you just couldn't kind of refuse, really. and it was so torn because, you know, there wasn't going to be many reasons that I was going to leave the Welsh environment, because that was, I thought I was set to sort of just stay there for a long term then. And there's a reason why people stay at that, in that environment so long, is because of the how they go about their work and the standards and values they work to, and, you know, just the culture they've got, and the environment it is to work in. That, you know, you wouldn't swap many environments for, you know, for that. And but the environment at Paphos that the guys wanted to create, you know, was probably exactly the same, if not slightly similar. And, you know, that's where we wanted to go. So I think, you know, in terms of coming in here, and it was obviously a bit of a surprise for people, think, well, wow, we moved to Cyprus. It's not even, you know, it's not exactly France, is it? It's not just over an hour's flight away. It's 5 hours on a plane some days. So, no, it's been good so far. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I tell you what, they just about missed out on the playoffs by a point. Obviously, COVID put a halt to the playoffs, and, yeah, we won't know who would have ended up winning the title officially, even though I think Omine would have done it anyway. I'm not going to say that. But, you know, you got some decent players there. Only Vallecari had a good season with 5 goals. I think he only got 1 assist. But he's a very promising Finnish midfielder, attacking midfielder. You've also got Marcelo Torres up front.
Yeah.
But from a performance analysis perspective, you not knowing much about, I presume you didn't know much about the Cypriot League going over there. What would you say was your first major challenge?
Well, there's a few. So again, it was, do you know what? I approached it in a similar way I approached the Welsh women's role.
Right.
Before interviewing for it. So what I did with, before I interviewed for Wales, is just sort of used my instincts, really. You know, okay, let's watch a few games. Let's get to know the players within the league as well. So I did that when I was sort of discussing the job, the quick scouts around the league. And the obvious one that everyone kind of points to, I'm sure you're not a massive fan of this, being an Ammonia fan, but obviously the success of Applewell.
Ah, yes. Thanks for mentioning it.
And obviously, over the last sort of decade or so, maybe a little bit more, they've popped up now and again in Europe, and that's where, from a UK perspective, you sort of noticed that. And obviously then actually going to the Cyprus Cup of Wales, I actually watched a Cypriot League game, so I knew of the league. You couldn't comment on anything like that standard wise, but you've seen them play. And as you referred to the squad, I mean, you know, since Cameron's come in, obviously I joined a month after. But what they've instilled, and the group, you know, to the credit of the group and the staff and the environment, they've, you know, every day it's application and appreciation is second to none. And that's something why, again, you live for in the job, that what you're doing has been appreciated, you know, also again, and then also, you know, they're applying themselves. And it doesn't matter whatever the results are. As long as application and effort is there, you know, you can't fault that.
Yeah, and it seems to be a renaissance at the club. I know in the years they had Jerzy Engel, who's the head coach, Polish fella. Nurklinger was there at the time, late 2000s, 2008, 2009 season. But then the likes of Stephen Presley turned up, Jeremy Steele was there for a bit of time, and obviously Cameron Toshak has turned up. And I think the club is on the rise. It's not a massive club in Cyprus. I wouldn't say it's steeped in history in terms of winning trophies, because it's been on Moni Arboil. You might have Isle winning the title, Apollonim with a shout. So I wouldn't say historically they're one of the top 4 or 5 teams. No. But you can tell there's a structure there. And I think a lot of people on the island are taking note that you've got an owner that's very, very serious about this club. And to be fair, it wouldn't surprise me if you qualify for Europe within the next 2 to 3 seasons. Now, is that an aim, to be competitive, to be winning the title or competing for Europe immediately? Or is the chairman or the owner saying to you guys, well, we know it's a process, we know we're a few years behind the others, but we can get there?
I think to be honest, with our approach to things, when Cameron and Gary it was in a completely different situation to probably what was probably regarded as the aim and maybe the season, you know, start of the previous season. So obviously it became a bit more of a rescue mission and get them into a respectable league finish. And obviously actually we ended up finishing in our highest ever position. So there's plaudits to be had there for the guys and obviously the players as well. In terms of long-term ambitions, I think, you know, in terms of how we want to work, we're building a structure where, you know, very multidisciplinary process where we want to, everyone's got a role and responsibility within the environment. And, you know, if we come together then we're nicely planned and organised, you know, then that's you sort of should hopefully see then a progression on last season. That would be the aim, you know, progress year by year. But you got to be aware as well, football, time, these types of things is not always a given. So you've got to ensure you've got your successful games in there as well.
Brilliant, fantastic. All right, one more thing before I let you go. What do you enjoy most about being at the club at the moment?
I have to say, I've already said it. I think said too early on the call, and I think if I can split it into two or three things, if that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Players, not just as people, but again, how they apply themselves day by day. You know, Matt, you got to respect that. Everything, application, effort is always there. You can't question, no fault that. Staff, again, you know, the appreciation of where you've come from and, you know, being new to the island, loads of help and support there. But then also, like, okay, this is where we want to go. And we're all sort of striving together to achieve something. That'd be lovely if we could. Obviously, like, the highest result in Paphos' history last season is a great thing that we've already started with. And again, the people on the island, you know, they're very, very, not just respectful, but also just so welcoming and lovely. You know, like, obviously, me and my girlfriend, we're both over this year. She's going to be teaching one of the schools. You know, we're really taking to life there, and it's not just something where we, you know, it's been a, all right, let's up and move from UK. You know, let's really invest our time into Cyprus. And, you know, I want to try and, from a personal perspective in a performance analysis department, I don't think many of the clubs in Cyprus have analysts from what I'm aware of. Mm. Actually, I think I know Ammonia have actually got one, but I'm not sure about the other clubs. The games I've been to last season, I didn't see any others.
Oh, wow.
So okay. I have to find myself quite fortunate in that respect. And that's why I'm striving to think, okay, my department needs to be the best one on the island and, you know, ensure that I do the best I can to help the people around me in the environment and, you know, see them improve and hopefully see our club's results, you know, continue on the upturn and the curve.
Brilliant. Well, Charlie, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Really, really appreciate it. And I'll tell you why, because it's like 11 o'clock out there at the moment. So you're probably getting ready for bed.
I'm used to the late nights as an analyst. It's okay.
Well, mate, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we could do this again sometime.
Yeah, nice one, mate. That's no problem. I'll
Great
do
stuff.
It soon.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Have a good evening, mate. Cheers.
You too.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Right, that was Charlie Mitchell, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you guys enjoyed that show. I did. So, give us a follow on Twitter at Shoot Defence. We have an Instagram page and a Facebook page. So, until next time, take care.